3, 2, 1.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm on camera, so I have to wait.
Here we
go. All right, testing 1, 2, 3. So, good morning, Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. For those whom I haven't met, my name is Alex Hecht. I'm one of the members of the Beit Midrash here. I'd like to especially thank David and Serena Kaczynski for their sponsorship of the overall program, and Nathan Kirsch for sponsorship of this and many other shiurim in memory of his beloved parents, Lou and Ruth Kirsch, and his beloved brother, Jerry Kirsch. To say Nathan is someone who I really see every week, who comes to my Shabbos morning shiurim, so he's really given me a lot of encouragement since I've arrived, so it means a lot. So, as you know, we pick different categories and facets to discuss about each of the Yomim Tovim that are coming up next month in Tishrei. And so in Rosh Hashanah, I'd like to discuss Tefillah. And when I took this topic, I was thinking, Rosh Hashanah, Tefillah, what comes to mind first? And in my head, it was playing HaMelech. And then I also realized why I pursued a career other than Chazanist. But it's something that, for me, and I imagine many others, is a very moving, stirring experience when we hear that HaMelech at the beginning of Shacharis, HaMelech HaKadosh, the references of kingship throughout the davening, and especially during Musaf. And it's something that I think evokes a certain pomp and circumstance and is something special and is unique to that time of year. But, then I wonder, what exactly does it mean? Does it mean anything tangible? Is it something that's just meant to excite us and invoke imagery? But is there something that, we're trying to accomplish by saying this, and something that we're also supposed to receive and inculcate? So before I continue, I'm just curious. How do some of you relate to this idea of declaring Hashem the Melech, the King, on the high holidays? Yes. It's the whole idea of Rosh Hashanah, meaning it's the beginning of the year. And right, how do we begin the year without declaring Hashem our ruler? Yes. Right, it's very appropriate for the theme of the day, where it's the beginning of the period of judgment, and we reference that in our davening. And who's the ultimate judge in a society that is a king? It's the king. The king has the power to take life and to otherwise direct the path of the nation. Yes. So that we have direction, that we connect to him, he connects with us, and also this is something that we're saying at the beginning of the year. Yes? Right, and that's of course very, very important to keep in mind. God is not physical, God is not lacking. But there's certainly a certain sense of anthropomorphic imagery that's there, and perhaps it's for us. And I want to explore. Perhaps there's even, in whatever way we can understand it, that we're even giving something or fulfilling a role in Hashem's plan. So, just to begin, we see in source one the Talmud says that the verses that we recite in the Musaf davening. The Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros, the kingships, the remembrances, and the sounding of the shofar are all things that are indispensable. Why do we do this? Says Malchios in Source 1, Kadesh, To crown you, so that you will crown me as king over you. Remembrance, so that we're remembered for good, and the means by which we establish this is through the shofar. So saying these verses is indispensable. Another place in tefillah during Rosh Hashanah and until after Yom Kippur is we change the end of the bracha, Hakel HaKadosh, the Holy God, to HaMelech HaKadosh, to the Holy King. And in fact, if one says the regular conclusion of the blessing, one would actually have to repeat the davening. It's considered so essential. So the question is, what does it really mean? What are we exactly doing? One, how can we? Is it of significance? And why is it really so indispensable? So there are a couple of different approaches I want to explore, and many of them are quite similar to some of the ideas that have been expressed so far. And I want to just look a little bit more closely. So one approach, you see this in Source 2 from Yosef Albo, is that in order to receive a favorable judgment, we have to remind ourselves about what we're supposed to believe. This is something that's essential to being a practicing Jew, is we have to have certain beliefs, if we inculcate those beliefs, so that will help us, that will help ensure that we have a favorable judgment. So really, essentially, it's reinforcing our own faith. He says, I'll read the English, that correspond to the following three principles that call our attention to the fact that properly believing in these principles, together with the dogmas derived from them shall we win a favorable verdict in the divine judgment. So we have kingship, we have malchios, corresponds to the principle of the existence of God. In order to have a favorable judgment, in order to enter the new year, we have to at least reinforce within ourselves the basics. We have belief in God. We have the zichronos, the remembrances, points to God's providence in the world and reward and punishment. And as we're being judged, these are things that we have to keep in mind. And shofarot really alludes to revelation, that the fundamental principle of our faith is that Hashem revealed himself to the Jewish people. And this is something, it sounds like, essentially what Rav Albo is saying is, we need the reminder. It's really to remind us. We want to have a favorable judgment. And by saying these verses, we're reminded of things that we need to keep in mind during the year, namely belief in the existence of God, belief in his providence and reward and punishment, and belief in, really better said, conviction of the fact that we received the Torah from Hashem. So essentially, it's a reminder for us, which we really need once a year. And I think that could also explain, if we say the regular text of the bracha, Hakel HaKadosh, instead of HaMelech HaKadosh, so we're not getting that reminder. We really need to reinforce that. The next approach is that of the Sfas Emes, one of the early Rebbes from the Hasidic dynasty of Gur, and he takes a somewhat esoteric approach. He said, in some way, the Jewish people are in a unique position to, maybe even just by living as they're supposed to teach humanity about God's sovereignty in the world. He says in Source 3, through your hands shall my sovereignty be revealed in the world. The question, because the underlying question is, what do you mean? How does a human reveal God's sovereignty in the world? What is that all about? It says, he continues, Kolam umlo, all the world and its fullness. Eino kedai, she's galam malchuso yisbarach shemo aleihem. I'm not worthy, really. We live in a physical world. It's really not, we're not worthy of having this type of revelation be so imminent. He says, Rak. B'nei Yisrael b'koach ha'avos, only by medium of the Jewish people, from the power that our patriarchs Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov gave us from the fact Avraham discovered Hashem, and through this he left a legacy, he left an incredible ability, v'koach HaTorah, and the fact that we received the Torah, shemelabendas lanu hachokma lamod al mohus upnimius sabria, that through this influence of the patriarchs and from the wisdom of the Torah, we are given an ability, and I think really just by living as we do, by living properly, we're given an ability in a certain esoteric way to be a model and to teach humanity about the existence of God, about the sovereignty of God. So this is one approach. The following approach, which I want to spend some time on, is there's a saying, Ein melech belo am, that there's no king without a nation, which makes a lot of sense. You could be the king, you can have everything in the world, but you have no nation, it doesn't mean much that you're the king. So in a certain sense, God, as it were, quote-unquote, needs us to commit to being his nation in order for his sovereignty in the world to be fully apparent. And as mentioned, God is not lacking, God doesn't need anything from us, but in order for his presence and his influence to exist in the world, really we are acting as partners with God. And you look at source 4, on Friday we say the following Psalm of the day, B'shishi ayom omrim, Hashem malach uslavesh, the Lord reigns, he is clothed with majesty. So what does that mean? Hashem shegomar malachto umelach aleihem. This alludes to the fact that on Friday, God completed his creation, and only then he was able to be considered a melech, be considered a king. Turn over the page, source number 5, Rabbeinu Bechaye, mentions why these are particularly important on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Because, as we saw in the previous source, Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of the world, really the birthday of the creation of man, and therefore it's incumbent upon us to mention the fact that as the psalmist said, that this is really when God's sovereignty was significant. And the next source from the Siddur, from the prayer Adon Olam, something that's maybe familiar to us. You say, Adon Olam Asher Malach, the king of the world who ruled before any creature was created, B'terem Kol Yitzir Nivra, before any creature was created, Le'es Nasa B'cheftso Kol, and at the time they were made, Azai Melech Shemo Nikra. Only at that point was he called a king. So we see that it's significant that we declare Hashem our king, that we act as Hashem's people. And this statement, Ein melech below am, that there's no king without a people, so what does that tell us from our perspective? What's that? Right, right. Without his, he's not a king. He doesn't have subjects, right? But if you note, it doesn't say there's not a king without subjects or without individuals who follow him. He said, "Ein melech belo am." There's not a king without a nation. So it seems that what we're trying to do will really not be significant, will really not be accomplished if we don't view ourselves as a nation. And I think this is very important to take with us in the coming year. We're not just individual Jews, we're not just different factions. Okay, there are different approaches within the Jewish community, but we have to view ourselves as a nation. If we don't identify with other Jews, even Jews who are not so similar to us, then we haven't really accomplished this idea of being a nation. So I think it's also crucial. Not that there's not a king without subjects, but there's not a king without a nation. Right, the Yishchad Balevecha, and that's when they were able, by doing that, they were able to receive the Torah. they're just individuals, it was unlikely that would happen. It was only by virtue and merit of them being a nation. To emphasize this point, in source 7, Shishun David Pinchas brings a fascinating illustration of this from really a human king. He says in source 7, we find the statement in Chazal, in the Talmud. It says, when King David sought to kill Nabal, he was approached by Abigail, who is then Nabal's wife, who asked why he intended to kill her husband without first judging him. And David answered her, he's a rebel against the king, and it's not necessary to judge him. There are certain unique rules to people who rebel against the king, that the due process is different. But Abigail responded, Shaul is still alive. And okay, while you're technically the king, you've been anointed as the king, no one really knows that. No one really recognizes that. And therefore, it perhaps made even David's abilities and his rights and privileges as king to be impossible without the nation recognizing him as such. And Rapinkas points out that David had already been anointed by Shmuel after Shaul was deposed, but he was not considered king until he actually practiced his kingship. And Rapinkas says that the idea of your renown is spread in the world means it needs to come to practical expression. When there's law and order in a country, when there are roads, hospitals, etc., when the rule of government is practically expressed, and very crucially, when people see it in action. So when people reinforce it in themselves, when people are following the laws, when people come to appreciate what the king is doing and the significance of the king's rule, he says only then it is malchus, only then it is kingship. By contrast, and he's discussing why we say Hamelech HaKadosh, that Hamelech seems to be something more imminent, and Kadosh is something that's separated and elevated above everything. Yes? That's a really, really interesting point. I think it could be that, and this is just my idea, I think it could be that during these days, there's a certain, and we see this even with the way some of the commentaries speak about Elul, and the prophet Yeshayahu says there's a certain closeness in these days, that we still have the Kadosh aspect, we still have the holy, he's not like a human king, but there is an aspect of Hashem and a relationship that might be easier to connect to that maybe isn't available in the same way during the year. Yes?
I just want to ask when why did we change that from Melech to Melech? We're still saying Melech anyways.
We're still saying Melech anyways, and interestingly, if one uses the regular conclusion for that blessing, so they would not repeat, right. It's not considered as essential. Could be that it's more direct. It's not just that, especially because the king is judging now. So this is really his primary characteristic that during this time of year. I think that could be why we emphasize that. We emphasize the fact that the king is acting in judgment. Not just that he appreciates or loves judgment, but that he's really acting according to the attribute of judgment. In general, I think we find that monarchy is a difficult. It's not necessarily a system of government that most of us would say that would be ideal, right? We live in a democracy, as imperfect as it may be, but would anyone really prefer a monarchy?
Unfortunately, the monarchies we've seen have not been.
You live in them.
Canada.
Who are the queen? Right. Of course. Well, I guess constitutional monarchy. Right. They've been despots. And you see here how did a king get to power? Especially if there was another regime, they'd rule by force. They'd go to war. They'd take captives. They'd assert their authority. But if we see when we're talking about Melech, in the sense, at least how we relate to Hashem, is he's not that kind of king. We see in Source 8 that God rules through consent and not coercion. Source 8, it says, from Tehillim, Ki Hashem Hamlucha Umoshel Bagoyim. So kingships is Hashem, and Moshel, it uses a double language. So one is kingship, the other is a type of rulership. And in Source 9, the Malbim says, what's the difference? A Moshel, a ruler, rules by force. That he takes power and he asserts himself, and that's why he's the ruler. It says Yosef sometimes carried this title. Sometimes Yosef ruled in this type of fashion. So whereas Melech governs with consent of the people. The people want the king. They know that the king is only acting for their own good. So if there was a king like that, would people want democracy? Monarchy?
A benevolent king.
So would you rather a benevolent king or a democracy like we have now? Right.
It really is.
So I think
the monarch that we're under is also the longest reigning monarch.
That is true. I know for a son, for Charles, it's... Right. So I guess here we have a little bit of both. I guess in the U.S. we've kind of been away from that model for a while. So certainly there's a security that you could have from having checks and balances and the ability for the people to vote. But what do you have on the flip side? You have politicians who are also ruling. They're also campaigning for themselves. They don't necessarily have the will of the people. Some do, but many don't. So perhaps we could say that even on a human level, that maybe if there actually was such a king, maybe there hasn't been really, and maybe that's why we're so kind of averse to the idea of at least an absolute monarchy. But if such a king existed. Said you save a lot of money on campaigning, a lot of money of you could do something else than going to the polls and watching debates and this and that, and getting upset about who was elected and who wasn't. It might be a good system. Yes?
You have the tyranny of the majority in a democracy, which is not as good as benevolent.
Right, even in democracy you have the tyranny of the majority. Right, you saw that in the French Revolution, you saw that a certain group gains power, and it doesn't necessarily solve the problem that some parts of the population are marginalized, they're oppressed. So that's true. So it certainly hasn't.
And you have a long-term planning of the world as opposed to every 4 years and you campaign together. Like, you can't get things done.
Right. There are short-term.
So if you really have a benevolent kingdom, who's concerned about the well-being.
Right. The terms are short. Then once they get to year two or three, they're already campaigning for the next term. So there's less of an ability to, also big places have term limits, so there's less of an ability to really focus on ruling for the people. And again, the problem with monarchy is, yes?
Also, I don't think the word Melech was used to humanize God. I think it's just used to create an image that when we're davening on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that we think of the relationship that God has to us in terms of the image of king, the same way we think of Shabbat. So the image is of the Malkah, the queen. So we know Shabbat is not a queen. We know
not literally,
king,
right.
But the imagery of Shabbat is of a queen, of a Malkah. So the imagery of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is that Hashem is like a Melech.
Right, 100%. And I think, we see the nature of, again, just an analogy, but the nature of the way Hashem rules is one that we're trying to say Hashem is the king, not a king who should be a despot, but a king who should rule with our consent. And really, in fact, what we do is we give our consent. So next thing I want to discuss is, what does this mean practically? Meaning, okay, even without this whole idea of Hashem being our king, we're still supposed to follow the rules the rest of the year. Why do we have this whole business with making Hashem our king? Just follow the Torah. Follow the Torah. We know Hashem says this, doesn't say that. Okay, do what we're supposed to do. Why do we have this whole idea, even this imagery of making Hashem our king? Is that more than just following the rules?
Well,
Yes.
We're establishing a monarchy for ourselves. It's almost a democratic process. Every year we're ourselves. We're saying, like, it's not just that the chef is done. Like, I think you're using monarchy in the same way you're using dictatorships. So we're not viewing the chef as a dictator. We're actually just doing the chef's position. We're coordinating the chef every year.
Right. So he is all... Right. So he is all powerful, but we are emphasizing the fact that we are giving our not the consent, but enthusiasm about it. The last thing I want to look at is like, what's the difference between saying considering Hashem our king, or just okay, following the rules. It's not that we don't have to follow the rules the rest of the year, and now we're saying Hashem is our king. So there's a medrash in source 10 which speaks about when Hashem was revealing himself at Har Sinai. So he says that he insisted that the people accept them as their king. He says in source 10 in the English, he says three lines up, "For if they do not accept my rule, they will not accept my decrees." So therefore, even though they were at Har Sinai, they were presumably willing to accept the Torah, this wouldn't have been done in a real meaningful way if they, at least long term and in a real commitment, had they not accepted Hashem as king. And the last thing I want to look at, I thought it was a beautiful piece from Yaakov Weinberg, and he says that there's a difference between obeying Hashem as king and being his subjects. He says, if only obeying him as king, my essential self has not changed. I am who I am with all my needs and desires, all my likes and dislikes. Just I have agreed to limit my needs and forgo my desires to serve him. So in effect, I have two identities, I as myself and I as being obedient to him. By contrast, if I actually make him my king and become his subject, I have transformed my identity. All I am now is a subject and servant of his majesty. My ultimate pleasure is to fulfill his will, and this is the only thing of significance for me. So it's not just that I'm following the rules. When I'm declaring myself a subject of the king, it becomes my identity. It becomes everything that I'm committed to. It really becomes a relationship. We share a common mission. I think this is why it's more than just observing what Hashem says, but why it's so essential and indispensable as we start the year to really declare that we want this type of relationship. We're not just going to continue as usual following the Torah, but we're renewing ourselves to being a subjects of the king, to making that our identity, that making that our ultimate mission in life. So with this, I hope we should, all merit to be able to, in a way that's meaningful to us, be mamlech Hashem, to coronate Hashem as our king, and have a ksima v'chasima tova, be sealed for very good things in the coming year.